You are listening to the Star Lores Podcast.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Why, you stuck up, half witted, scruffy looking nerf herder!
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
An ancient profession, quote, both infamous and anonymous at the same time, bounty hunters are far more than mercenaries for hire. They're heirs to a professional legacy, an ancient brotherhood with a glorious history, unquote. Speaker and date unknown.
There are many ways a being can earn a living in the galaxy far, far away. One could raise nerfs, for example, and sell their hides and meat. One could mine plasma on Naboo, or farm moisture on Tatooine. The widespread nature of the galaxy also affords a more lucrative vocation. Those with a thirst for adventure, an acquisitive, perhaps avaricious, attitudes towards capital are attracted to this field. They are cunning, perseverant, and violent. They are bounty hunters. Although bounty hunters frequently kill their sentient prey, and others in the process, they are not assassins or mercenaries per se, though such individuals may sometimes hunt bounties. Aura Singh is this kind of cutthroat bounty hunter. Many other hunters do work that is legally sanctioned by local governments, simply arresting criminals. The Galactic Empire made heavy use of bounty hunters. Six in particular give us a bird's eye view of the dangerous career path, of the ethics and history of bounty hunting. This executor's row consists of Boshk, Dengar, Forlom, Zuckuss, IG-88, and Boba Fett. These beings were all extremely dangerous hunters in their era, but there are many hunters with equivalent reputations throughout history. The practice of bounty hunting is widespread, and an important part of most worlds in the galactic community's culture and economy. The practice has been ongoing for at least 5 millennia, and cultural Mandalorians are never far from the profession. Other subcultures, who are highly represented in bounty hunting, have customs that lend to the profession, such as Gans, Trandoshans, and Corellians. Although there are hunters from virtually every sentient species in the galactic community, including droids. On worlds with little in the way of infrastructure to support courts or professional police services, bounty hunters find healthy markets for their trade. They track down felony suspects and return them to local authorities. Sometimes local authorities are nothing more than a megalomaniacal hut and a band of hired thugs. Other times, they are sophisticated small-scale governments who simply lack resources to maintain a local police force, but can occasionally shell out a few thousand credits to track down a thief or local farm equipment. Many believe that the majority of the bounty hunting work carried out in the galaxy is little more than common thuggery and gangster enforcement, and this belief is not without merit. Most beings who conduct large, outlawed economic enterprises employ bounty hunters as a matter of course. In part, hunters employed by gangsters battle legal authorities when necessary, but also fight against rival black market leaders. Examples of criminals who employed bounty hunters are Davik Kang and Jabba the Hutt. Legitimate authorities, such as Darth Vader, also retain bounty hunting services on the Empire's behalf. Circa 4000 BBY, the profession was not highly regulated, and hunters could simply walk into a bounty office on many worlds and accept acquisitions with little in the way of vetting. During this time, special bounties were offered on the most dangerous individuals in the galaxy, aside from experienced bounty hunters, Jedi Knights. It is this tension between Jedi and hunters that led to the creation of the Bounty Hunters Guild. At some point prior to the Old Sith Wars, the Jedi Order requested that the Republic Senate do something about the lawless and dangerous hunters, whose work often overlapped with Jedi missions. The Senate decided that the best way to bring some semblance of order to bounty hunting was for the hunters to police themselves by creating professional organizations and guilds. These groups would create and follow their own bylaws, as well as keep records of their activities. Many specialist groups formed at first, eventually uniting under the umbrella of the Bounty Hunters Guild, which persisted for millennia. People in need of bounty hunting services would contact a guild representative and offer a requisite amount of credits for the collection of the acquisition. Live capture was the gold standard for professional bounty hunters, though sometimes the person paying for the acquisition did not care, or even stipulated that the acquisition not to be captured alive. By the Galactic Civil War, the Guild was officially a holding of the Galactic Empire, serving as an extension of its justice system. It was headquartered inside the planetoid Salakatori Anchorage. The Rebellion used bounty hunting services far less than the Empire, in part because the guerrilla organization lacked the capital to pay for the service, though they also generally disapproved of their methods. Additionally, the goals of the Rebellion were not really law enforcement, which is much of what bounty hunters do. When working for the Rebellion, bounty hunters typically served as bodyguards or worked in distinct but related field of mercenary services. During the Clone Wars and the Old Sith Wars, a specialization of bounty hunters emerged. These Jedi Killers were represented in the Guild's chapter, Crimson Nova, among 8 other specialty chapters. In the Old Sith Wars, the Crime Lord Godo created the market on Jedi lives when he placed large open bounties on them, hoping to diminish their population. In Godo's logic, he reasoned that the galaxy would be a much safer place with fewer Force adepts waging catastrophic wars against each other. He looked to the previous 50 years of collateral damage spread across space by warring Force adept denominations as evidence. Dirge, a hulking Gendai cyborg bounty hunter, is known to have slain many Jedi over millennia-spanning career. He started during the New Sith Wars, circa 2000 BBY, and hunted until his death in 19 BBY. In the Clone Wars, Asajj Ventress contributed to a revival of the trade in Jedi life by offering bounties on the heads of members of the Monastic Order. Order 66 collapsed the Jedi hunting market, and the industry was partly nationalized by organizations like the Emperor's Hands following the collapse. Crimson Nova alumni, such as Zuckuss, still occasionally hunted surviving Jedi following the Clone Wars. Aside from the Sith and other Force adept denominations, bounty hunters probably have more Jedi blood on their collective manipulative appendages than any other group. Ara Sing hunted Jedi during the Empire's reign and following the Battle of Endor. She was born on Nar Shaddaa, a moon covered in one megalopolis, with close association with criminal empires like Black Sun, the Hutts, and the Exchange. Despite a brief stint as a Padawan in the Jedi Order, Sing's life would remain deeply entwined with the economic circumstances of her birthplace, the galaxy's underworld. By the Clone Wars, she had a well-established reputation as a Jedi killer, and had seen Anakin Skywalker pod racing on Tatooine, sensing his power from a cliffside overhang. She worked for Count Dooku in the Clone Wars and Darth Vader in the Imperial period. She was still actively hunting Jedi by 40 ABY, but was arrested for the attempted regicide of Queen Mother Tenel Ka by Galactic Alliance authorities.
The Creed. There are many organizations throughout galactic history who have supported the bounty hunting profession. As such, there are many varying interpretations of ethics endorsed by bounty hunters. It nevertheless does help us understand general behavior displayed by hunters by examining the unwritten code followed by the Bounty Hunters Guild, the premier bounty hunting professional organization. It should be noted that the faith which guild members adhered to their creed was highly variable between individuals. No bounty is worth dying for. This aspect of the code illustrates one of the most important points about bounty hunters. They are self-interested above all else. They do what they do for the credits. Whether hunting an acquisition for local law enforcement, or for a thug with credits to spend on spite, they care first and foremost about their own safety and profit margins. To this end, most bounty hunters wear some sort of combat armor. Some can withstand even a lightsaber blade, like Beskar steel battle armor worn by Mandalorians, or Kotosis-laced alloys. Durasteel, or even woven materials, are also worn for protection. In some cases, a bounty hunter's armor comes from their biology. The Gan species have exoskeletons, like insects, but scaled up to anthropoid size. The chitinous bone exoskeleton can be as effective as some fabricated body armor. People don't have bounties. Only acquisitions have bounties. Since bounty hunting does not explicitly require hunters to behave immorally, many hunters hold on to some shred of scruples. The job does, however, often require that they do things to acquisitions which go against the social contract or conventional morality. In order to circumvent this, they engage in a process used by groups who do unsavory things to other beings. They dehumanize, or perhaps desensitize, their targets. They view them not as individuals, but as acquisitions. They cognitively and linguistically transform their prey into objects rather than beings, through the careful use of language. Capturing or killing a being who got into some bad debt might make one feel guilty, or even empathic towards the debtor, but capturing or killing an acquisition is no different than hunting a nerf for food. Capture by design, kill by necessity. This tells us that the common conflation of bounty hunters with mercenaries and assassins is not accurate. In most cases, the conditions of an acquisition stipulate that they be returned to the person who offered it, oftentimes to face justice or to turn over information. Sometimes acquisitions offer so much resistance to capture that the only option for a hunter endorsing the code is to kill them, since no bounty is worth dying for. The Empire legally codified the conditions under which bounty hunters are permitted to kill. Basically, if the Empire considered a being dangerous, they could be killed on sight by a hunter with no legal repercussions. It is considered poor craft to kill acquisitions when it is uncalled for. The rewards for captured acquisitions are also often higher. Many bounty hunters are therefore skilled in methods of non-lethal combat, the administration of sedation drugs, and carry non-lethal weapons. Both Ara Singh and IG-88 dispense sedating gas as such a tool. Capturing acquisitions also requires significant planning. Hunters may observe acquisitions from afar for some time, until they can make an approach. They stalk their prey as any predator does. This means that if a being is unfortunate enough to be an acquisition, a reptilian like Bossk or a man like Fett view that being as a crate dragon views a dewback. No hunter shall slay another hunter. Like many ethical guidelines, the bounty hunter creed is only as good as its adherents. In general, bounty hunters contain their violent acts to the pursuit of prey, but there are many exceptions. This prohibition was largely ignored during the bounty hunter wars in 1 ABY. Any being capable of destroying a bounty hunter must themselves have a high explosive yield, as it were. IG-88B, in fact, made a point of always leaving a trail of burned, battered, and exploded things in his wake. Boba Fett had a reputation for disintegrated acquisitions. No hunter shall interfere with another's hunt. Like the previous code, this one is adhered to loosely. Hunters on the executor's row, for example, virtually all interfered with one another's hunt for Han Solo, practically immediately. This can perhaps be explained by the personal grudges many of them held against the smuggler-turned-rebel, the high price offered by Darth Vader, and the fact that they were all briefed and dispatched from the same location. Inter-hunter competition was practically unavoidable. And to that, the fact that these veterans survived a war by breaking their creed, and violence between hunters was a sure thing. In the hunt, one captures or kills, never both. It is not necessary to be cruel or inhumane in order to hunt bounties. It would be cruel to go through the trouble of capturing an acquisition, only to kill it once in the holding cell of a ship. Since bounty hunters do have a shred of morality, the guild therefore locks down on such blatant acts of sadism. Because of this preference for taking acquisitions live, containment systems are necessary. Since hunters usually need to transport acquisitions between star systems or planets, a freighter sized starship is usually owned by successful hunters. Ships have to be large enough for at least a single holding cell. Bars, manacles, force shields, freezing and carbonite, and simple lengths of cord are all used for restraining and transporting live acquisitions. Bounty hunters often name their ships with feral, predatory, or intimidating language. Examples are Slave One, The Punishing One, or Hound's Tooth. No hunter shall refuse aid to another hunter. This rule is also only loosely followed. Many bounty hunting partnerships do arise, in which duos like Zuckuss and Forlom pursue acquisitions as a team and split the credits. Others like Boba Fett and Ara Sing may only team up for a brief period in pursuit of a single acquisition, but mostly work alone. All of the executors row, for example, had a history of occasionally joining forces with one another. Although Boba Fett did not help the hunters he competed against for the Solo acquisition, he only disabled their vessels or otherwise left them defenseless, but alive when he could have easily killed them. That is probably as close to help as one could get from a man like Fett. The Executor's Row.
In 3 ABY, following the Battle of Hoth, from the ashes of the Bounty Hunter Wars, Darth Vader summoned six of the fiercest survivors to the command deck of his superstar destroyer, Executor. This ship was as imposing a figure as its captain, reaching a stunning length of 19 kilometers. And had only recently been built. Perhaps the crew was simply inexperienced in the operation of the largest battleship in the known galaxy, and that explains their failure on Hoth, allowing Han Solo and Luke Skywalker to escape the battle there. In part, Vader trotted the row out to the command deck to humiliate Executor's crew, since they had failed so spectacularly on Hoth.
Payback.
Before working with the Rebels, a young Corellian named Dengar was an aspiring swoop pilot. While still a hopeful on the circuit, Dengar crossed paths with an equally skilled pilot, Han Solo. Eventually, on a particularly dangerous and unsanctioned race, Dengar had a horrific crash on his swoop bike, for which Han Solo was largely responsible. In the crash, Dengar suffered a traumatic brain injury, having crystalline plant shards penetrate his skull and enter his brain. Imperial doctors then brought him back to a relative state of health by using experimental cybernetic procedures. Permanent mood or behavior changes are a known outcome of traumatic brain injuries. In particular, the damage to his brain resulted in a flattening of emotions. Dengar's Imperial doctors could only restore the emotions of rage, hope, and loneliness. Once recovered, Dengar had been dismissed from professional swoop racing, since the race against Solo was not sanctioned. With nothing left, Dengar resumed his life of violence. Killing was not new to him, as he had been an active and successful bounty hunter all throughout the Clone Wars. Post-recovery, Dengar assassinated political and military targets for the Empire. Over the course of his work, he acquired various pieces of Imperial equipment, which included pieces of Sandtrooper, Snowtrooper, and Stormtrooper armor. Far from the discipline Stormtroopers applied to their gear, Dengar had allowed his armor to rust and decay by the time he set foot on Exequator. He wore a turban, at first as a fashion statement, and later to cover up his scars and cybernetic implants. The personality changes he underwent eventually drove him to betray the Empire that saved his life. His rage found a new target for catharsis, the Galactic Empire. He resumed work as an independent bounty hunter, and whenever he had the opportunity, assassinated Imperials using his Falcon 38 blaster rifle, although he also had a preference for using explosives. He caught the eye of the Rebel Alliance during the Civil War, and the ire of the Empire for his betrayal. While traveling aboard his ship, the Punishing One, in 3 ABY, Dengar exited hyperspace at an unfortunate time and place for a person wanted by the Empire. The Battle of Hoth. The Punishing One was disabled in the crossfire above the ice world, and Dengar was taken captive aboard Exequator. He was shortly offered amnesty for his crimes against the Empire in exchange for pursuing the bounty on Han Solo's head. Since their fateful swoop race, Dengar often visualized Han when executing Prey, and he was at this time already plotting to betray the rebels and collect the bounty on the spacer. He agreed to the Empire's conditions and soon had an audience with Darth Vader.
The Uncanny Two.
The Gand Huntsman Zuckuss and the Loam series protocol droid Forloam are a rare example of a successful, long-term bounty hunting duo. While there are other duos like Boba Fett and Dengar or Guri and Dash Rendar, Four and Zuckuss had a rapport and longevity that is somewhat unique. Forloam started his existence as a protocol droid aboard a luxury starliner. His body was generally anthropoid and resembled outer paneling on 3PO series droids, but was darker and somewhat rusted out later in existence. His head was not anthropoid and was dominated by two enormous compound photoreceptors, giving him an insectoid appearance. He was originally intended to work with an insectoid species, and this design feature was meant to make interpersonal interactions with such beings easier. Eventually, some error in Four's programming caused him to wish to expand his behavioral capacities. He somehow learned how to code droids, and then overwrote his initial programming. The upgraded Forloam expanded his protocol droid subroutines to include all the behaviors and cognitive processes necessary for a life of crime. His entree into the criminal economic sector included larceny and information brokerage. When Jabba the Hutt hired him, his programming was upgraded more, including the skills necessary for bounty hunting. Jabba soon made the managerial decision to pair Forloam with another up-and-coming hunter, Zuckuss. The Uncanny One, as his colleagues called him, was a force-sensitive finesman from the planet Gand, His homeworld had an atmosphere thick with ammonia, and so whenever away from the world's rarefied air, he had to wear a respirator that hid his face. The planet Gand has a trade specialization called Finesmen among the insectoid Gand species. These individuals were experts at navigating the fog-drenched hinterlands between settlements in ancient times. Eventually, their superior navigational and geographic knowledge became useful to warlords, as well as to locate and apprehend criminals. Finesmen eventually absorbed shamanistic practices into their profession and would use divination to locate targets, as well as worship ammonia clouds as distinct entities. In such a ritualistic context, the powers of the Force are sure to be of use, and many Force-sensitives in the world gravitated towards the Finesman profession. Zuckuss had both of these traits, but he also had a liability, or rather, several. Zuckuss suffered from at least two mental illnesses, schizophrenia, as well as dissociative identity disorder, previously known as multiple personality disorder. These were not documented until after 6 ABY, however, the twilight of his career. It is not known if he had the disorders prior to this, though they rarely emerge so late in an adult's life. Since these disorders can cause significant impairments in daily functioning, he may have required a perfectly rational, tireless, and methodical advocate to help him navigate the danger of the galaxy. Somebody like Forlorn. A third medical liability entered Zuckuss's life around 3 ABY. During a hunt, he accidentally inhaled oxygen, which caused a degenerative and painful lung condition. Forlorn and Zuckuss received a summons to a rendezvous aboard Darth Vader's battlecruiser. They had death warrants on their heads from the Empire, but Zuckuss was headed for an extremely painful death in a matter of time anyway. There was a possible cure to his condition, cloning and transplanting his lungs. This required far more money than the duo had, 50,000 credits. Fearing a trap, but desperate to live, Zuckuss and Forlorn flew aboard his ship, the Mist Hunter, to the Hoth system.
Third fastest blaster slinger in the Outer Rim.
You're welcome to what's left. Boba Fett to Ugnaught workers on Cloud City after deactivating IG-88B. 3 ABY. Boba Fett may have held the undisputed reputation of being the most dangerous bounty hunter in the galaxy, but IG-88B was the runner-up. Although he certainly engaged in economically motivated bounty hunting, this assassin droid also hunted for political reasons. B's father, IG-88A, copied all of his memories and uploaded them onto a computer, then downloaded replicas of his consciousness into three other IG series droids. From there, they traveled to Mechas 3, and with his children started a droid revolution. He had plans to start a galactic droid revolution with his children, though these plans never got far off the ground. To ramp up their plans, however, they would require Imperial attention and scrutiny to be diverted from the ancient droid-producing planet. IG-88B was elected amongst his brothers to attract that attention, so the revolution could proceed in secrecy. Towards this end, he specifically hunted bounties that were particularly likely to involve a lot of violence and collateral damage in both lives and property. He made specific use of small explosives, causing as much mayhem as logistically possible. Imperial law enforcement reported at one point that IG-88B had killed at least 150 beings. Although he was also wanted by Imperial authorities, he saw answering Vader's call to be an opportunity to wreak the kind of havoc and reap the amount of credits that his programming dictated. D
devours his prey.
Bossk lived up to the transliteration of his name in Dosh, the Trandoshan language. The first prey he devoured were his siblings, shortly after hatching from his egg. This impressed his father, Kradosk, and made the old bounty hunter proud. Perhaps Kradosk would have done better to discourage this behavior in Bossk, for his son would kill and devour his father in order to wrest control of the Bounty Hunters Guild. Bossk then formed the Reform Committee, guild members who wanted to do things differently and thought of older members as old and lazy. The Reform Committee, led by Bossk and Fett, fought a civil war against the true guild, and this conflict became known as the Bounty Hunter Wars. Before that, he was a well-known and infamous bounty hunter and slaver. In particular, he loved to hunt bounties on Wookiees, which few other hunters had the courage or skill to do. When he killed Wookiees, he skinned them and sold their pelts. It is no surprise that he often took imperial acquisitions due to their mutually held attitudes and policies towards Wookiees. One Wookiee in particular, along with his Corellian business partner, attracted animus from Bossk. He was all too happy to fly the Hound's Tooth aboard the Executor.
Devours themself.
After Boba Fett acquired both the Imperial and the Hutt bounties on Captain Solo's head, the remnants of the Bounty Hunters Guild collapsed on itself. The guild's infighting killed most of its members off after 1ABY. Boba Fett largely engineered the ultimate outcome of the conflict, using Machiavellian tactics to allow a social Darwinist conception of survival of the fittest to play out. At its conclusion, he wrote the Bounty Hunter's Code, which was a combination of treatise on bounty hunting and political manifesto about Death Watch. Dengar eventually settled down to a married life after receiving a cybernetic procedure from his wife, Manaru. This restored much of his emotional functioning, and violence lost its appeal, though Dengar engaged in occasional acquisitions or combat for years after officially retiring. IG-88B was deactivated by the penultimate blaster slinger, Boba Fett, on Bespin. The Mandalorian bequeathed IG's lifeless corpse of metal and plastoids to Ugnaught laborers working in Cloud City's foundry. The would-be revolutionary was presumably turned into scrap. His brothers C and D left Mechas III to continue his work, but were similarly dismantled by the end of the Solo affair. Zuckuss recovered from his lung condition, but suffered a second grievous wound fighting with the rebels in the war. Forlom nursed his partner back to health. Eventually, Forlom was damaged, and his memory, therefore, personality and self, were erased. He was no longer the droid Zuckuss knew as his closest friend. The two ended their professional partnership, though both continued to the trade independently. Eventually, Zuckuss was admitted to a New Republic psychiatric hospital on Coruscant, sometime after 6ABY. Bossk eventually retired and would cross paths with Han Solo decades later. In the ensuing interaction, the reptile insulted Han deeply and received a broken nose in payment. The space station Bossk was living on was destroyed, but he is presumed to have survived by using an escape pod. The Bounty Hunters Guild reemerged as a presence in the galactic community sometime before 137ABY.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
See that Imperial over there with the garrison of towering metal-plated monstrosities? Armed to their robotic facsimile teeth with heavy repeating blasters and plasma cannons? Yeah, he looks real tough and smug, doesn't he? Yesterday's news! Have no fear, the new SD-10 battle droid is equipped with self-healing metal armor, shields, and a tactical software program loaded with all of the previous SD-9 series strategies and programming, making them the perfect droid to break the chains of your Imperial oppressors. Come to Balmora Foundries today and get a special offer on the most advanced battle droid the galaxy has ever seen. Tell him Drebel sent you. Welcome aboard the Millennial Falcon. I'm Sam.
This is Christian.
And this is Jordan.
All right, guys. So we're talking about bounty hunters. We haven't flown by any, like, floating fields of space debris lately, have we, where some bounty hunter might be hiding his ship?
Waiting to follow us.
Garbage or something like that.
Bounty hunters are garbage. Galaxy's garbage.
Nothing on my radar so far.
We did lose our reflector or our radar dish again on off the top there. So if you hear some random sounds here, that's just we're picking up stray radio transmissions from another galaxy. So about Boba Fett, obviously we're doing an episode on bounty hunters. We can't not mention the greatest of them all. He's the GOAT in the bounty hunting game. Mm-hmm. But he certainly deserves his own episode. Really, we were talking about this. We could easily do a trilogy of Boba Fett episodes. We could do
a whole podcast.
We could do a whole podcast just about his armor, just about Slave One, just about his philosophy. Yeah. Never mind anything that he actually did. But for this portion, I want to focus in on one little aspect of Fett's career. And that is, do we believe Dash Rendar's tale that he beat Boba Fett in single combat?
Well, Rendar is a proven rebel liar.
Yeah, I think so.
So, no.
Has the Shadows episode come out yet? I don't even remember.
No.
Well, that's coming up.
In anticipation for that.
In anticipation. There's reasons to not believe everything Dash Rendar tells says. About himself. And the fight he had with Boba Fett on Gaul, Dash Rendar tracked him there to the spaceport. Fett had recently been in battle against, I can't remember if it was IG-88.
Yeah.
Was it IG-88?
Yeah.
And so his Slave One was disabled, and so he had to go to Gaul to get repaired by some Imperial buddies, and then Dash tracked him there. And although he did beat him in combat, he didn't manage to extract Han Solo from the carbon freezing place, which is why I kind of don't believe that he did beat Boba Fett, because I think if he did, he would have recovered Han.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have. If he'd really beaten Fett, he wouldn't have let him get away.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also, there's his armor. It's not Beskar steel though, right?
That's thrown into question. It's complicated.
It's Durasteel. I thought I remembered.
Really? I know Jango Fett's armor was Durasteel. I don't know if Boba Fett's is Durasteel and when and where. And there's a lot of things. And then, like, if you're doing canon or legends, that's kind of evolved as well. So,
another thing is, it's sad that IG-88 died, and the last of his line. Or do we support his droid revolution, especially in the context of the Star Wars universe, where a lot of droids that are used just for manual labor seem to be sentient, which doesn't seem fair to me.
That will be a whole other episode again. But in the meantime, we can have all the galactic college students wear red t-shirts with a portrait of IG-88 with his beret on.
I think that's appropriate. I think IG-88 was doing some good things for the galaxy. And you know, aside from blowing up all those... It's also interesting that he was essentially running a false flag operation against a one-man false flag operation against the Empire just to distract them from the revolution on Mechas, which apparently worked for the most part. And that's always fun. And then also he had his brothers, who's they all had the same personality, right? That was just copied off of IG-88A.
So
B is the one, he died. You can actually see his corpse in not Return of the Jedi, The Empire Strikes Back. There's actually a brief scene in the foundry with, I think it's where Chewie finds C-3PO.
Yeah.
And IG-88 is actually leaned up against a wall right near to like the furnace where you put in metal to turn it down to slag. So we assume that that's what happened to IG-88 after. I could be wrong. Things like that in canon do tend to last a long time. Like also on Cloud City, Luke Skywalker's hand and lightsaber were actually recovered later on in canon properties, which is funny.
Yeah.
Which IG was the one in The Mandalorian?
So I'm not sure.
The IG, there's a whole thing around the IG series. Again, it could be its own other episode, but the IG series of droids is not exclusive to the IG-88 that we're talking about specifically. So
yeah, they were all built as assassin droids or whatever.
So the one in the Mandalorian, like the canon, now keep in mind, obviously, with Legends being thrown out, we don't know how much of this stuff still matters even. Yeah. Like IG's whole story could be completely null and void. In which case they're just generic assassin droids in the Star Wars Mandalorian series.
That's sort of the headcanon I did with it, because the IG-88A, he's the one who started the
masterminding
the Mechas III revolution. That was an aberration, right? That wasn't part of the IG-88.
Yeah.
The IG series initial programming. That was a mistake, yes, essentially. So I think that the IG droid in
The Mandalorian,
because there's no mention of more than A, B, C, and D, who are all destroyed. There's no mention of any additional IG droids getting that.
There is programming. So IG-88 does put his consciousness even into things like the Death Star. So,
oh really?
Yes. So it's more complicated than
there's
that.
Like a secret matrix type.
There's movie. A lot going on with IG-88. It's actually a very fascinating story. Again,
did he send his consciousness and or programming to something
elsewhere?
After?
Yeah. So that's exactly it. Like,
and he uploaded it onto a computer mainframe first, right? And
yeah. So he's a ghost in a machine, and he can just inhabit bodies or clone himself as programming and.
Yeah.
So the IG story is fairly complicated, and I think we will save it for its own standalone episode. But all that stuff is obviously thrown out with Legends and doesn't apply to Disney's Mandalorian series unless they choose to resurrect it.
Right. And so then in the old Sith Wars, and then also after the Jedi Purge, there was like this market essentially created on Jedi lives, and then in both cases, that market kind of eventually crashed, just like an old fishery, because they overfished the Jedi. They overharvested them.
Yeah.
So I wondered how, you know, what became of Crimson Nova? Did they have to like go on the dole after the purge or something?
Government relief checks?
No. I will say about
Imperial
like,
relief.
I will say in like in Legends about the hunting of Jedis, it just seems to me that in almost every story, there's always that one Jedi that escaped. It's like, did they really kill them all off? Because there seems to be a hell of a lot
that
Jedi
survived.
Yeah,
Order
66. Actually made it through.
Yeah.
I don't think it's actually entirely clear how many Jedis were actually killed, like at that specific Order 66 moment.
And then how
because
long
it would
the
have
purge?
Only been the Jedi who were deployed in combat with clone troopers, right?
No, but Darth Vader was hunting them
for a while.
But then Darth Vader was hunting them for a long time. And there was only 10,000 Jedi.
Yeah.
All the Jedi in the galaxy at that time
numbered
10,000, which is not that much.
But even if you kill...
When the Imperial military has trillions of people in it.
Yeah, but if you kill even 9,000 out of the 10,000, that's still 1,000 survivors scattered around the galaxy, which is a decent number, right? It just depends on the
survivors with magic powers as well.
Sure, yes. I'm not discrediting how dangerous they are, but I would say even in the collapse of the market of Jedi hunting, I would imagine it's just become super rare and super dangerous to hunt as well. So if you did happen to find a Jedi, the payout, I'm sure, would be exceptional.
We also see that sort of effect, that social Darwinism effect that Boba Fett kind of had employed on the bounty hunters, where only the most vicious or sneaky Jedis would have survived.
I would just say one thing again to my previous point, though, is that the movie The Return of the Jedi implied that the Jedi were entirely gone and have now returned within Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
But it seems like in the EU stuff, there's always more and more and more.
Okay, so
there's not a ton, though. There's like maybe a dozen left over.
There's more than a
dozen. I feel like, there's even
There's a tribe.
Yeah,
there's one like tribe of Force Sensitives, but they're not Jedi.
Tribe. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, Force Sensitives in general also wouldn't have been exterminated.
Yeah, yeah.
And the entire Imperial period before the Return of the Jedi, you got to think that the Empire's actively hunting Jedi, hiring bounty hunters to hunt Jedi, hunting them, Darth Vader personally hunting Jedi. For 20 years, is it? Between...
The Purge is 19 BBY and then to 0 BBY.
So for 20 years, right? So hunting people for 20 years, their numbers are going to dwindle by the time of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
How many of them were killed, right? Probably tons.
Yeah,
point that they're reduced to a couple.
I'm just saying in the movies, it seemed it's heavily implied that there were 0 Jedi.
Yes.
Whereas like in the EU stuff, it's like, actually, just a small gripe. It's not something that hill to die on. But
even in the original, though, yeah, all the Jedi are dead except for Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda.
There are a couple.
It's already there that clearly survivors were a thing that can happen.
Yeah.
I don't know how many Jedi were actually left. I just tried to Google it.
After like the fall of destruction of the
Death Star. I'm going to guess that in the EU, at least name checked, it's like no more than 25. Survivors,
maybe,
which seems like kind of a realistic number,
maybe,
given how powerful Jedi are, right? And if they were just on
and how big the galaxy is,
if they're just on some remote world in the unknown regions when Order 66 went out, like that lady who lived on Nar Shaddaa and gave Leia a lightsaber, anyway,
or that ant creature. Also,
oh yes, yes. What was it? Ood?
Yeah,
literally just Ood. An ant.
That's literally what it was.
He didn't walk though.
No, that's true.
Although Nettie can walk because his species does occur at other places in the EU.
Okay,
but they're like not rooted into the ground that way.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
But
back to bounty hunters.
Back to bounty hunters. So they're kind of like the true space cowboys of Star Wars. Like they are, I mean, bounty hunters, even in the pulp fiction of Western literature, are
even
literally
in real life
a very
Western
common character. And they're very similar to these bounty hunters.
Yeah.
Sort of on the sociopath, you know, antisocial personality.
The quiet stranger that rolls into town, engages in violence, and then leaves again. Yeah.
Precisely. Shoots up a saloon.
Archetype, yes.
And then there's sort of, I noticed a predatory kind of theme really popping up, which is obvious with the word bounty hunter, but it really hit home to me because I've read a lot of books and listened to like a lot of podcasts about serial killers and stuff. And I thought when I was reading about all these bounty hunters, like kits, like their loadouts and all their restraining equipment and stuff, and then the fact that like they stalk their prey for so long, I'm like, these guys really sound and behave a lot like serial killers because a lot of them
They're very predatory, very much so.
Yeah,
they have this very,
even some of the species that are associated heavily with bounty hunting, like Trandoshans, are very
Bossk. I think this really creeped me out, sort of thinking about it. If I was wanted and Bossk was the
hunting
guy who was
you?
Trying to hunt
you
me,
might get eaten.
That would be horrifying. He's just like this giant
like,
lizard man.
Like the predator from the what are they called? Yungtai?
What?
The predators have an actual species name.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They're Quarren from Star Wars. Didn't you know that? The tentacle guys from Mon Calamari.
Crossover episode.
They're literally the same
as
the Predators.
I'm pretty sure there is I'm pretty sure there is a comic, a comic around a Star Wars versus Predator.
I think there is a crossover comic.
We'll have to dig it up. Yeah. I've seen fan art that I've enjoyed.
And then there's some other, some just bounty hunter quick points. Aura Singh, she's one of these fun characters who has like half a frame in the Star Wars
movies. Episode one. Yeah.
But then has this gigantic extended story. You see her in the pod racing scene.
Yeah.
Anakin crosses a canyon or whatever and she looks down at him. She's like this super, super like desert goth. Yeah. She's like really pale and has like dark circles under her eyes and she's bald and
now
has,
did
like, antenna.
Did Lucas actually have a character in mind for her, or was that just like someone
I don't know
EU expanded.
I haven't looked into her enough, although she is a really fun character because she's one of those Jedi killers. So she's force sensitive and she occasionally uses lightsabers and stuff.
If I'm not mistaken, I think some of the she started out in the concept art field and like evolved into the character as Sasha Ventress too.
Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken, they bear a striking similarity in the whole Jedi history. They kind of share as well. So I think there's some kind of overlap there where maybe in the initial stages of movie planning that started as an idea that they kind of abandoned, but it was picked up and resurrected by the EU, which happens quite a bit as well.
For sure. And then there's Dirge. I wish I would have got him in our cyborgs episode because he's pretty excellent. The gigantic Gendai cyborg, and he's got a really interesting history too because he was like trained by a Mandalorian battlemaster, yet he hated Mandalorians. He not only specialized in hunting Jedis,
he specifically,
but he also hunted Mandalorians, which he's like, that makes him the scariest bounty hunter, I think, even more than Boba Fett.
He's also nine vulnerable,
and he's spiteful. Like, Boba Fett's just an automaton, right? But Dirge, like, he's killing you because he'll
torture you.
He likes to, and he's sadistic and stuff. So he's a different class of hunter altogether.
Yeah,
and I think you were mentioning earlier some of there's lots of great bounty hunter characters, but in sort of the Old Republic era.
Yeah, Kallo Nord is one of them Knights of the Old Republic, who is infamous in his time. And that's the thing, like, the bounty hunter trade is so old. I hope we emphasize that in our podcast that, like, you know, we know characters like Jango Fett and Boba Fett in their times, but there were also key bounty hunters in the past too, like Kallo Nord in the Knights of the Old Republic era, who is infamous. You have characters like what's his name? I forget the species. He's a Duro bounty hunter. He appears in the Clone Wars.
Cad Bane,
yes.
Cad Bane, very cool.
Who kind of fills in the void after Jango Fett is killed and becomes the top tier bounty hunter. I mean, there are so many bounty hunters. You could go on and on.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to give some shout outs to some.
Absolutely. We see you. We see you, Cad Bane. We see you, Kallo Nord.
We just don't want them to come after us if we don't mention them.
Please don't see us. I probably shouldn't mention that we have to drop out of hyperspace and because we're coming up on the Balmora system then. Hopefully Cad didn't hear that. And we'll see you next time on the Star Lores podcast. May the Forks be with you. Thanks for flying with us. Jordan here. Just wanted to let everyone know what's happening here at the Star Lores podcast. Star Lores is now on Discord. If you would like to join the Star Lores Cantina Discord server, you can find a link in the description or on any of our social media accounts. Reach out with a DM or email. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter by searching the Star Lores podcast. Go ahead and give our page a like and send us a message. You can also email at starlorespodcast@gmail.com. Send us your fan art, Star Wars collections, or fan fictions, and you may even get a feature on one of our pages or even the show. Don't be afraid to offer corrections or add to any of the topics that we discuss on the show. We are also on Patreon. So if you want to help us pay the bills, as well as get a few awesome perks like bonus episodes, access to the private Facebook group, or the VIP section of the Discord server, head on over to patreon.com/StarLores and sign up for as little as $1 a month. And finally, make sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher app or YouTube, as well as sending us a 5-star review on iTunes. This really helps us reach a wider audience. Enjoy the rest of the show.